Karen, if you would please do the roll call.
Debbie Berry.
Here.
Bruce Rinker.
Here.
Dan Moore. Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Are these the microphones?
Did you put your button underneath? It's called a power button.
I should have known I'd do that.
So dependent.
All right, we got our tech in place. Can I have a motion, thank you, please, to approve the minutes from the May 20th meeting?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And we'll jump right into the financial report, Wade.
Okay, thanks. I'll let Dave's going to put it up on the screen here and we'll walk through the.
You've got a busy day.
May results. It's a Sean Gale.
Sorry, Sean. No technology. That's okay. Getting everything ready.
We're going to do it in Morse code.
Wouldn't that be something?
I'm sorry, the main presentation laptop has first.
Just start, Wade.
I'm going to go ahead, okay.
Yep.
It's cold this morning. All righty. While we're trying to get to that so that we can stay on our timeline, the first, let's just start at the overview. You've gotten financial statements and the information that went out. I did want to raise up in the month of May, you'll notice a fairly large difference between May of 21 and May of 22 as it relates to local government grants and gifts. And the and the primary reason for that is if you look at year to date in 2021, we had $3.9 million in federal grants, $1.1 million in state grants. This year in this period, this in the year to date, if you look at the May results, we had no federal or state grants received in the metro parks this month. So it's just, it's going to throw that off. Year to date, if you look at that, $9 million to $2.8 million. Primarily, we had a lot of federal and state grants coming in. As we've talked about often, a lot of it was related to Tiger and the trails and the things we were doing. So no cause for concern. We just didn't receive any federal grants. The other thing that might jump out at you this month in May of 2022, in the other category, we had $597,000 in revenue. And that primarily relates to the carbon credits. We received $566,000 from the Oregon Climate Trust. And I think much credit goes to Rose for helping.
And Connie and Natural Resources, yes.
Okay. Because that is a huge windfall for the Park District. And again, in this month, $566,000 in carbon grants. Okay, I guess we're up. So we can go to, you want to go to the first slide, Dave?
Sure.
Oh, too. Okay. Thank you. Sit down. All right. Now we're in. Okay. Sorry for that. The other thing that I just wanted to raise up at the overview level, you'll notice in the month of May, salaries and benefits, $5.9 million compared to last year in May, about 4.8, and we've talked about this for the last few months. We've returned to more normalized staffing levels in 2022. So salary and benefits expenses are going to be up compared to the prior year, and you're going to hear that as we talk about the individual departments. We're at a more normalized staffing level now as compared to last year. We'll go to the next page. The one thing to raise up here in number four, you'll see zoo admissions. It's down slightly compared to May of 21 in talking with Dr. Kuhar at the zoo. We still had a lot of attendees, but what we were noticing in May of this year was more attendees on Monday, which is free Monday, more students, more groups like that. So I didn't want anyone to feel that attendance is good, but the attendance was happening on days when we were having large public groups where there was not as much revenue. If you look at the year-to-date in terms of general admission, we're at 1.37 million to 1.4 million, so things are going well there. Otherwise, if you look at salaries and benefits, we're going to talk about this on every slide. You can see in May of 22, in year-to-date 2022, salaries and benefits are up. Again, we're at a more normalized staffing level.
Plus, we're talking about an increase in what's being paid.
I'm sorry?
We're paying, wages have gone up.
Yeah, wages have gone up slightly. Yeah. Wages have gone up slightly. And but the primary reason for the increase is still to have more employees, not it. So much the wage being paid. We just have more staff on.
Okay, thanks.
So the next slide, the golf course. Okay, let me see which one we wanted to talk about there. Basically, it's important to point out the revenue on the top. 726 outpaces the greens fees for last year. And you can look at year to date, we're almost caught up with where we were. We had talked about this last month. May and April were really tough months. In talking to Damian, May was great. A lot of golfers playing, greens fees and other revenue sources are up. So revenue for the month was up. We're still a little bit down year to date, primarily because March and April were so tough. We talked about that last month. 11 sunny days, 50 gray days, and a lot of rain. So, but they're making headway there. They're doing well. Again, salaries and benefits, this one's a little bit different. If you look down at the salaries and benefits line, it was $337,000 last year in May. This year it's $455,000. And that's because there were some key positions that weren't filled in May of 2021. So we had our golf director, Damian, came on in June. We had no manager at Shawnee at that time. And we did not have our turf manager at Washington. So those three key positions are why those salaries were a little bit lower in May. And then they're lagging year to date, but those will catch up. Golf courses are staffed appropriately, according to Damian, and things are going really, really well. So that's good news on the golf front.
I noticed the pro services have gone up quite a bit too. That's
yes, compliments to the to the managers that have been brought in. They're just giving a lot more lessons. They're doing classes, and so yeah, they're really driving revenue there. So yeah, from a golf standpoint, if we continue to get weather like we've been getting in May and in June, things are going to be fine. They're going to take care of themselves. It's just you can't make up for rained out days.
Sure.
And rain and weather, the organization can't control that. So let's just keep hoping for continued good weather. This is the individual chart. We share this. There really isn't a big story to tell other than you can see that we're revenues. If you just go right to Big Met, revenues for the month of May 2022 are almost identical. I had to look at that to make sure that wasn't a typo to what they were in May of 2021, which that just means now we're getting a more normalized level of play, which we didn't see that when we looked at March and April. And that's pretty much true across the board. I always raise up Washington because when you look down at the operating revenues, in terms of their operating surplus subsidy, they're almost on par with last year. They're doing a great job with the First Tee program. They do a lot of camps. In fact, Washington and Shawnee and Seneca were doing camps. And so it's getting people out to the golf courses. They're using the facilities, and we're just really happy with how things are going. And if weather keeps holding the way it is, golf is going to be really, really good. On the enterprise front, other revenues, if you'll look at other revenues, May of 21, it's 101,000 to May of 22, 156,000, and that carries through to the year to date. The primary driver there is parking, and we've talked about that. That you'll see that in the detail. Dock rentals, it's negative variance year to date of $181,000. And I think Commissioner Moore had asked last time, that's primarily due to how the dock rental fees were paid, and it's down this year because of the timing when dock rental fees were paid. And if they were paid, excuse me, in December of 21, they're showing up last year, even though some of those were 22 revenues. But all of our docks are full and that operation is going well. When you go to some of the detail, you can see that Merwin's Wharf, if you go first, revenues are close to where they were in 21. Again, operating expenses, which includes salary and other things, that the real driver here, when we talk about enterprise, we tend to talk about salary. The other challenge they're having is there are increases in food and beverage costs, increases in other commodities, and we had a lot of purchases. So as an example, spirits, if you were looking at 2021, just Merwin's, we purchased, about $500 worth of spirits in 21 cash basis. This year we purchased $11,000 in spirits. Not that they're consuming all of that, but it's just how you're purchasing your inventory. They needed to purchase inventory in May. So you'll see some of those operating expenses level off in June for somewhere like Merwin's because they bought their spirits and other food sources. Yes, Commissioner.
Are we increasing selling prices in these places? For example, at Merwin's, is the budget, are we getting our higher cost of goods back in higher revenues?
The direct answer is no. Once they've set their prices on their menu and things like that, so as commodity prices and things increase, that does have a negative effect on us, and it's probably something we'll need to look at. But when they establish their prices, whether it be for their menu items or for their beverages, they didn't adjust those, and with the cost of commodities increasing, it is eating into profit.
It's cheaper to reprint the menus.
I agree. I will share that with management and see. We'll see what they want to do about that. The hard part, and this is just my opinion, is that as costs go up, many times you don't want to keep adjusting the prices in your menus and things. When someone comes in, if all of a sudden something was $4 and now it's $5 and now it's $6, that could have, I guess, a negative effect. But we probably do need to look at our pricing.
Yeah,
there's a whole policy discussion.
But the point is, everyone's used to the inflation now, and
nobody likes it.
No one likes it, but you know, if you're in that business, you've got to.
My point, I think it's a policy decision because we're a little bit different business.
Yeah. And commissioners, to clarify, you. We didn't change the pricing. We just don't change them necessarily day by day. So we have updated the pricing to account for some of those costs.
Okay.
Anywhere of them leading up to the season. So when we updated the menus, we did take into account, so if you look at your year-to-year comparison, those menu items have prices. I think what you were referring to is we're not constantly changing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have accounted for some of those costs.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah.
And the other part of, and there you can see two things that we like to point out that are, and it's important to know what's working well. Parking is just knocking it out of the park. You can see operating surplus year to date, $153,000, which are resources that can be then redeployed to other areas of the park's mission. And as well as the chalet is just having a great year to date. And the chalet primarily, building rentals are up, food sales are up, and just general admission and use is up in calendar year 22 compared to 21.
One measurement is inflation is 8%. And so if you go to the supermarket, you've all noticed that. And so don't be I think one of the things that's hurting business the most is people not reflecting the new economic climate. And so I think it's very important to you know, if just because you did it at the beginning of the year, it doesn't mean you can't do it mid-season. We have to get in the habit of making sure that our revenue is our food cost, for example, at Merlin's is a certain percentage of what our revenue is.
I agree, Commissioner. I think that's what Joe was alluding to when they set their prices and they looked at the strategy for operations at the beginning of the year, they factored that in. And as Commissioner Rinker mentioned, it's probably a discussion that, from a board standpoint with the CEO, how you want to go forward on pricing things. We are making money. When I say making, we're not a for-profit venture, but we have a margin that we want. That margin's gone down, but we're not doing it at a loss. It's just the margin is not as great.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a good point.
Commissioners, that's all I have on finance, unless there are any questions.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Moving on to new business tonight.
Good morning, everyone. This morning, we are honoring two retiring guests, Pamela, Sam Bowman, lead keeper, and Teresa Reiner, animal keeper at the zoo. Pamela Bowman spent more than 22 years as a general relief keeper, animal keeper, lead keeper for the zoo animal care division. She helped work on transitioning the lorikeet aviary to the new outback aviary. She's pivotal in leading her team to be the first successfully train tree kangaroos for voluntary blood draws. She has done an amazing job, and we will truly miss Pamela for her years of service at the zoo. Teresa Reiner, animal keeper for more than 41 years. She had just about every job and continued to improve herself over her period of time here, obtaining her MBA. She was a PCA lead keeper. She was instrumental in the day-to-day care of the first bachelor gorilla group that we received from the Lincoln Park Zoo in 1994. Her time, talents, and efforts will be truly missed here at Cleveland Metro Park Zoo. The recommended action recognizing Pamela Bowman and Teresa Reiner is in the mid-portion of page 9.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is 2022 budget adjustment number 6. Wade.
Thank you, Brian. Commissioners, you have in front of you a budget adjustment for $168,100, very modest. The details for it are on pages 36 and 37. This is to allocate already revenues, donations, and grants that we've received, so it's no new money. It's just allocation of dollars we have in hand of $168,100.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the proposed 2023 alternative tax budget. Wade.
Thanks, Brian. As you remember from the last meeting, you scheduled a public hearing on June the 3rd to consider a tax budget to be submitted to the County Budget Commission. That meeting was held on June 3rd. The proposed tax budget is in your packet of material. It lines up with the 10-year plan, except for some minor modifications, and as a follow-up to Commissioner Moore's one suggestion, in some items you'll notice down in contractual services, that goes down because we know what it's going to be, but in operations, you'll see a slight increase. That's about 3% because we're trying to factor in there is going to be an increase in costs next year. This is not our final budget. We'll come to you in December, but we have to submit at least what our best estimate is at this point, and that's what this is.
Recommended actions on the bottom of page 10.
Yeah, move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next on page 12 is the increase for sewer and sanitary waste services. This has been one of our very unique challenges over the last year and a half or so. The board did see this back in May of 2022. We did go over the estimate. We are working with the Cuyahoga County Treasurer as part of how we're working this business. They're providing some of the services, but we had to broker them out. This is for our increase in the sanitary sewer and waste removal at the various locations throughout Cleveland Metro Parks. Revised amount of consumption is on the middle portion of page 12.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the award of RFP 664B construction manager at risk for the Cleveland Metro Parks primate, cat, and aquatic building roof replacement. As we take pride in maintaining our structures across, we have noticed that we have some work to do on our roof over at primate, cat, and aquatic to make sure they can continue to stay. We did find 4 shortlist companies. We are recommending to the board this morning Constructability Incorporated as the highest and best to work through the pre-construction stages, general estimates, and cost percentages as we're going forward. The recommended action falls in the mid to bottom portion of page 14 to enter into the contract with Constructability Incorporated.
Can I just ask a question? So only 4 respondents this time. It seems like we've had a lot more in the past. Do you think that is due to just the market and, you know, people being busy, or do you think it is more due to this particular job and qualified firms? I'm just curious if you think this is a trend we'll see going forward that we'll have less folks. 4 is still a really good number, I think, but I'm just curious.
Good morning, and it's a great question. For the PCA roof and how unique that project is,
That's because we're asking
for a construction manager to get involved in what is a project that has a pretty narrowed scope. We're actually pretty happy that we got 4. We do expect with other projects that are on the books that we'll still see that robust response, especially with these delivery models, because it's not upfront design bid build, it's construction manager at risk and design build where we have time to lead up. And we see a lot of contractors want to work in that capacity.
Thank you, Sean. Yeah. And again, these bids look competitive. I just was kind of wondering.
As long as you're up there, question. This is the first time with this organization, right?
It is.
So we're confident.
We are confident. We have done, I don't want to say background checks. We've done voluminous reference checks.
That's what I
And Michelle Crawford with our organization has worked with them in her previous employment at Tri-C and was really impressed with how thorough they were. So we're really confident in what they can bring. They have proposed to us several times. They've not been successful as Best Value.
Oh, okay.
Now they are. So they're not an unknown entity to
right.
us. We've actually interviewed them before. They just weren't, they weren't successful.
Thanks.
Sean, while you're up, just one question. This isn't really the membrane of the roof. This is putting skylights in and that sort of stuff, right?
Actually, we are going to look at different roofing systems for the building, and we do expect that we will replace or expand the skylights and natural light that we're letting into the building for that animal care and just the general feeling in the building as well.
And what is this basically a square foot? Just if I can bore you with that.
We are looking at approximately a $2 million project, breaking that down to square foot. I can bring that back to you. I don't have it at the tip of my tongue right
but
now.
But you're restructuring, in other words.
We are. The roof at PCA is very, very unique. It was actually built with a lightweight concrete and then a membrane above it. So we've done a lot of testing in the past few years to figure out exactly how we can get this project done and, you know, extend the life of that building for decades to come.
Oh,
okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
The next is the Scranton Peninsula Public Riverfront Trail Joint Use Agreement. This is something that we continue to work on, complementary to the Vision for the Valley. Cleveland Metro Parks and Flats Forward Nonprofit Group are partnering together to bring, you can see on the map here, you might have to dim the lights just a little bit. Sean, do you want to come up and just break it down real quick? So again, this is a partnership with ODNR. This is Cleveland Metro Park's ability for the government portion of it to hold into place that the property will not expire for use in the 15-year period of time. We do these agreements at Bay Arts. We've done them with the Foundry. They needed a public takeout partner. This does connect to a wide variety of our trails that include Irish Town Bend, Cleveland Foundation Centennial Trail, and the towpath.
Can I ask a question? The 15 years, how does that work?
It just needs to make sure that, so when ODNR grants through a public agency, it needs to make sure that it stays in the public realm for that 15-year period of time, which is basically the depreciation cycle of it.
But will we have it after on the 16th?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Okay, so
just make sure that the funding isn't wasted.
Yeah, gotcha. I understand. Thanks a lot.
So the recommended action falls on the mid to bottom portion of page 15. Thank you, Sean.
Keep your hands to yourself. Move to approve.
All in favor. Second.
All in favor.
It's the weather.
Been one of those days.
I think we all approve that.
I appreciate the help. Construction manager guaranteed maximum price $16.21. Cleveland Metro Parks. This is for the tropical bear habitat expansion. The Board of Park Commissioners saw this almost a year ago. We have been working diligently with Panzeca Construction. We are looking at breaking ground here within the next 30 to 45 days. We are happy to be able to bring forward the tropical bear habitat expansion at the Cleveland Metro Park Zoo for a GMP of $7,691,643.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next construction is construction guaranteed maximum price number 4, contract 1558, construction manager at risk. This is for the Garfield Park Pond stream restoration. The board saw this back in November 19 of 2020. We have worked with Neroni to basically chunk each one of these, GMP 1, 2, 3. Now we're at 4. We've been able to work on controlling costs while keeping this project moving. This is the next phase of construction, Wolf Creek Restoration Armor and the cascading stone walls that we're working on. They have continued to work through the conditions, so we're very pleased to bring the GMP 4 for the Garfield Park Pond and Stream Restoration Project. Recommended action falls on the top portion of page 19.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the authorization of a land acquisition. This is the Marlin Investment Group, LLC. This is a 1.1 acre. This is in the Lakefront Reservation. Since the acquisition of Merwin's Wharf and Rivergate Park in 2021, we have had a very diligent strategy on creating high-quality public access between Lake Erie and through Wendy Park on the Cuyahoga River. We have worked with all of our partners to help create the vision for the valley and this what I would call a vision for connecting Riverwalk all the way through Cleveland, all the way through Canal Basin Park, through the RTA parcel, and then all the way down into what we would call the Flats project. So the properties align right in here. This is Rivergate Park here. This is the Foundry here. This Riverwalk already exists to this point right here. This is a 0.9 acre parcel of land. This is Cereal Foods, that there's some movement on investment. We would procure this and then continue to build the trail of Riverwalk all the way down. It'd be very complementary to the future work of Irishtown Bend. This trail is already completed here. This part is completed here, and so is the part to Wendy Park. And this part exists here. So it's helping create the cohesive vision of having this Riverwalk all the way through our public park, all the way down through Canal Basin and into the Flats.
That has the potential to be really transformative.
That's exciting.
That's our recommended action falls on the mid portion of page 20.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
But Brian, can I ask one question about the Irishtown Bend property? How does that, excuse me, I'm sorry. I know there was some stuff in the paper about the Port Authority having responsibility for shoring up. But didn't it also say that park would be a Port Authority project, or am I getting that mixed up?
I think just to break it down on the very highest level, the what I would call the armoring of the Cuyahoga River wall falls under what we would call the Port Authority and their state capital funds that they've been allocated over a period of time. Number two, Cleveland Metro Parks had been pushed through some funds through Cuyahoga County years ago to build the trail and trail connection. Land Studio held the easement for many years. Ohio City worked to help purchase along with West Creek through CMHA. So what I can tell you on a very high level, there are a lot of partners that are involved in it right now, and it's working through diligently kind of the processes and steps along the way.
Oh, okay, so to be determined, more or less. Okay, thanks.
The award of bids and RFPs, they fall on the top portion of page 21, various food purchases, Jacobson hybrid mowers, John Deere compact tractor, and Pitt toilet cleaning service. They fall on the top portion of page 21.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Vouchers and payroll?
Thank you. You'll have on page 31 of your packet resolution 22-06-079. A list of vouchers that have been processed. They were reviewed for legality and they conform with the Ohio Revised Code. And this resolution is asking the board to ratify those expenditures of a total amount of $8,934,550.42.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We have a second.
Yes, on page 32, you have another resolution, resolution 22-06-080. Again, it lists vouchers that have been reviewed for legality and conforms with the Ohio Revised Code, and we're asking the board to ratify those vouchers totaling $1,576.73.
Move to approve.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Dan Moore abstained.
I abstained. Good. Sorry about that.
Fantastic. Can you turn the lights back up again, and we will move to public comments. Would you like to start? If you go to the microphone, please, and introduce yourself.
My name's Patrick Cahill, 7648 Isaac Drive in Middlebrook Heights. And I was here a year ago, and for 23 years, the association is cutting, has been cutting grass in this area and also part of the park board of that property that borders the woods. And last year, and this is with park approval, they've been out a couple of times and didn't say anything about us cutting their grass and maintaining it. Nobody's using that area for their personal use either. Basically, last year at this meeting, the park decided to let that their area grow wild. It has now got weeds 3 feet tall. The area we're talking about is small. It's 13 feet by 400. It borders four houses. These people are senior citizens. They have allergies. They have asthma. We're getting all kinds of insects, ticks. But the main thing is breathing. This is only 8 yards from my deck, and everybody else's deck are about the same size from the field that the park has created. And all we're saying is, can we put it back how it was 23 years? Let us mow it, or if you want to mow it, that's fine, if you want the expense. But it's a health problem. I can't believe the board is more interested in weeds than people's health. Let me say that one more time. I don't believe the board is more interested in weeds than people's health. You're endangering these senior citizens' health with this weed growing that the park is doing. I believe the man in charge of our district for the park doesn't like us, but I can't prove it one way or the other. Again, I'll just one more time and then I'm done. Please look at this situation. You have pictures. This is how it looked before for 23 years. This is how it now looks with all the weeds for 1 year. This growth was just this year in 2022. Who knows what is going to happen in the next 5 years? Are we going to be 6 feet tall? Are we going to have ticks and all kinds of other things? Are we going to have weed pollen? The park asked us, their association ex-president, because I'm the president now, ex-president, to give the park $2,100 to plant 10 trees. These trees are now growing with wire mesh around them. So if somebody looks out their door, you're going to see all this wire mesh and a couple of trees planting. A couple other trees are dead. But again, the main reason for my talk is you're creating a health problem for the residents who are senior citizens. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Next, Hardy, would you like to?
Please. To carry on with the budget theme from your audit meeting, spoiler alert, some includes some criticism. It was disappointing that the comparisons to 2019 were dropped from the monthly financials. Historical data puts things in perspective, particularly when 2020 was such an outlier. In fact, the new budget book points out that 2020 was intentionally excluded from current budget planning. Please resume showing 2019 in your monthly and year-to-date financials. The budget book, which is always a useful reference, would also have benefited from including 2019's numbers. Moreover, while a conservative approach was emphasized, there was not always followed. For instance, for all of 2022, land is budgeted at $2.1 million, with a potential of 490 acres. Just today, $4 million, twice the whole year's allotment, is being spent on a mere 1.1 acres. This purchase is not contingent on grants, which are generally required before natural areas are acquired. Downtown projects sure vacuum up the money. In spite of being long delayed, the layout and graphics of the budget book are disappointing compared to prior years. Previously, selective color served to enhance departmental reports and graphs. This year, the colors are a distraction. The focus should be on facts and metrics, not on brightly colored columns of checked off boxes. Not sure that GFOA is so easily impressed. A more restrained presentation fits with a conservative budget process. Listing an annual goal as yes is hardly useful. A column of red X's does not look professional. Show last year's numbers and achievements as was done previously. Now some pages feature color, wide spacing, and large font, while important capital costs are crammed together in tiny print. Maybe the reader is supposed to be distracted by the color and flip past what is literally the fine print. Some material is well organized and clearly presented, and that is appreciated. Accessible information is why this format was a breakthrough historically. This year's production is a big step backwards from previous books, in my opinion. Limiting information does not fix problems. We were told that posting warning signs might create liability. Merely discussing operating results without CapEx does not fix the bottom line. One can make things look better in the short term, but over time, the truth will come out. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. Any additional comments? Yeah, please.
Good morning. My name is Andrea Kleinhens. I'm a resident of Parma, and we have a 28% tree canopy, so I like to go to the metro parks to, you know, for to seek refuge and respite, to replenish and regroup, which is what I was planning to do this past Monday. So that was just a few days ago. So, and just to give you a little, I go to Isaac Lake, which is adjacent, it's on Fultz Parkway and Big Creek in Middleburg Heights. My parents are buried adjacent there in the Woodside Cemetery. They were lovers of nature, which is part of the reason that they were buried there. So I go to Isaac Lake, as do a lot of people, to take in the sunset. The sunsets are just gorgeous there. And there's great blue heron and a giant egret, the snowy white egret, fish jumping out of Isaac Lake, which used to be a bell kettle, like, I guess it's very ancient. So, and the other thing I like about Lake Isaac is that it is, it's a humble little, you know, park. It doesn't have a lot of asphalt. People sit in their cars, even during storms, eat their lunch, you know, it's just a great place. But on Monday, instead of encountering peace, I was confronted with devastation. I went over the bridge. There is one thing that's spilled in there. I'm glad there aren't a lot of things. I went over the wooden bridge, and to the right, I saw a Metro Parks truck, and they were hot and sweaty. You could tell the employees had been working really hard. And I heard a lot of noise, machinery. I saw machinery beyond that. So I walked down the path, and there's this tree I always check out. It's so frail. It's about, but it's still hanging on. It's seen me through my father's death, my mother's death this past December. So then I come up the road, the path, because I'm on my way to a small pond in the back where about a month ago I saw 17 turtles, a wren, woodpeckers, I think it was a red belly. But I stopped because there was this huge road carved in the path. A full-sized road starting at Fultz, going all the way down to the towers. And this young man was, you know, riding the mower, whatever. I forgot what the machinery is called, but it picks up large pallets. So anyway, I asked him what he was doing, and he said he was operating machinery that, because First Energy had installed insulation in their new power lines. Now, I've been going there for 20 years, and I've never seen a road carved there, ever. And the place is so small, it really can't contain that kind of, I don't know what you would call it, butchery. It was brutal. It was a brutal sight. Now, unfortunately, I don't have a cell phone or anything, but I believe someone from the Park Service took a picture. Her name was Jennifer Hemler?
Hilmer.
So, and I'm glad she was there because I didn't have that. So I believe it's incumbent on the Metro Parks top administrators to ensure that agreements with companies like First Energy are bulletproof. In 2020, First Energy had a central role in a bribery scheme, you know, the goal of which was to get legislation passed that included a $1 billion bailout for two of its power plants in Ohio. And before that, they failed to pay on a, I don't know if it was a $20 million or $70 million fine. I was a little, it's a big jump, that was eventually waived by Jobs Ohio, which that's a whole other kind of interesting thing. So based on their history, it seems very possible that First Energy decided to act first and ask questions later in this latest debacle at Lake Isaac, which is like my heart. We are supposed to be stewards of the land, but more often than not, we've become destroyers. It seems that many individuals and corporations have become disconnected from a fundamental reality, and that is we are all part of this natural system. I think we're losing our soul. I know a few years ago there was a radio show about how the soul's going to become extinct. So anyway, my encounter with First Energy's brutality hurt. It kicked me in the gut. As a constituent and taxpayer, I am part of the Metro Parks. I hope you do the right thing with First Energy. I hope that the road is once again filled with vegetation so that someday there will no longer be evidence of the act, which I consider a desecration. And I just have one other thing. There's another person that can't be here. And so I just want to read his statement. His name is Black Elk. He died in 1950. He was an Ogallala Sioux Indian. A book was written about him, Black Elk Speaks. He wrote this poem, The Sheltering Tree. Hey, learn to hear, let's see, I don't have my glasses though, my feeble voice. Well, I think you might be in luck because the print's really small. At the center of the sacred hoop, you have, and I can't go any further because I can't read it. But anyway, he was a man that had a vision. He was, went through the, you know, brutality of Wounded Knee. His people were killed, but he had a vision when he was very young that they would rise again, and they didn't. So he was devastated. He was in despair. But even though he physically did not live on, I think his spirit still speaks. It spoke through me. The reason I was going to read this is because it was so, the emotional impact was the same emotions that I experienced. So anyway, I hope that you are able to do due diligence with First Energy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, we definitely will. Thank you for your comments. We'll look at the contract and make sure that First Energy didn't violate any of those provisions, and also follow up with Jen Hilmer.
Thank you, Rose. Did you have some comments as well?
Yes, good afternoon. Good morning, everybody. My name is Paul Sherlock. I'm a resident of Cleveland, and I'm here to bring up my concerns about access to Edgewater Park, specifically vehicle access. I first wanted to say, as a longtime user of Edgewater Park. I appreciate the improvements, dramatic improvements that you have done over the years at Edgewater. It is very noticeable. But I have noticed over the last couple of years that the beach has been restricted to access, as especially vehicle access. And my inquiries about why that restriction was put on was because of safety reasons. And, you know, I fully understand that there would be safety concerns regarding people gaining access to the beach. But I also recognize that the beach is, you know, a regional treasure, and it's one of the few public accesses to the beach for the entire region. And especially for people, you know, the underserved people within the city of Cleveland. And I feel that this is something that should be discussed in the public domain, as far as whether or not access should be restricted or not. I feel like, you know, okay, present the case of why safety is a concern, but let the public decide whether or not they want to allow that restriction to be continued. So that's it.
I think just as a clarifier, that the beach has never been closed. The park ends up full of cars, and so at that point in time the access is closed. We call them rolling closures, so they close for a period of time and then we get them reopened. The challenge is on the shoreway. They don't want the shoreway backing up from an accident standpoint, so we have to work very hard to try to keep it open. During the pandemic, the governor's office actually called and wanted the park shut down because there was too many people there. So we've really had our hands full with the amount of people that are going through. So please know that we've not ever closed the beach. The access to the tunnels are always open. But in some regards, from the parking, because it's been so popular, it's so full, it's been a challenge for us for sure.
I understand that. And, you know, I know that there was government decrees about you know, limiting the number of people. You know, we're, as we move away from this pandemic, or this pandemic, I feel like that should loosen up. And, you know, there was a long time where that field was used for parking, and now they're limiting it just to the parking spaces at the you know, at the beach. And I don't know if you cut down there on the weekends, but
I was just there 2 days ago.
There's still bottlenecks occurring on the shoreway there because people want to get into the beach and they're being turned away. So, you know, I see that as well. So I feel like that that grass parking area should be made accessible again. That's my concern.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, occasionally it is accessible, like when there's a bike event down there.
Yeah, we've been trying. So again, during the pandemic, we were pushed to keep things closed. The challenge is when you add all of that parking, it adds such a load on the park from a flow standpoint. It's not as controlled as a parking stall. People come out all different directions. They have to cross paths, so it does put people into safety.
Yeah, yeah.
So from that end, with working with the police to try to make sure that the park does stay as safe as we possibly can, we understand it's a challenge. We understand that it is a regional destination, more national. I mean, there are a ton of people that come through there, not only through there, but to get to the different, you know, marinas and yacht clubs along the way. So it is a challenge for us, for sure, for this, you know, the 3 month season.
But Brian, on the 4th of July, for example, it'll be completely jammed. So will people always be able to walk or ride bikes in?
Correct.
But the cars will just be the thing that's limited. Yeah.
Like I said, it's a challenge. It's become a very popular destination. So I just, yeah. I want to really clarify, the beach has not been ever closed. And we've had to manage yeah. the flow of cars through the facility.
So would it be possible to get the transit system to get buses?
There is a bus stop there. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you talk about walk and bike. Yes. I mean, it doesn't affect me personally because I bike there all the time. However, if you're from the Union Miles area, you're more apt to be driving in a car to come and use the beach. And so,
yeah,
it's just not really accessible for people that need to use a car in order to get to the beach.
Can we do remote parking?
Yeah, I think, again, I appreciate your comments. We wrestle with it. Our police chief is here, our operations. I mean, we work at it as hard as we can. The creation of the Wendy Park Bridge did allow for more access to parking there. Again, you have to have a bike to get in. We challenge people to come early to the park so that, their stay times are 3 hours. Sometimes they leave and then we get a turn. So, we do try to create those things. But as the neighborhood got built up too, less parking on that side as well. So it's been a compounding effect over the last number of years. I mean, it is really this iconic destination.
And it just continues to be something we try to manage. So,
and particularly if you're handicapped, of course, you can't, like my wife was down there and one of these crowded periods, and it was just too crowded to go there. I know, I feel your pain here, but I'm not sure there's a whole lot we can do about it, except maybe buses or something.
We'll keep looking.
Access to it from different points, and cause congestion and difficulty leaving. But there was somebody monitoring that and making sure people were parking in a orderly fashion. Maybe that would free less congestion, less problems, at least as far as the parking is.
Yeah, we'll continue to look at options. Again, obviously, we want people to have access and be able to get there. So,
Brian, on the 4th of July, will that grassy area be, I gotcha.
No, I mean, again, to your point, we've done those things.
Yeah,
but
I hear.
But then people leave on the all-purpose trail and drive right into the intersection. I mean, we've had it happen.
Yeah.
And so you've seen it, I mean, it's not a source. It's a challenge for us, and we can't just allow for people to go up the side of the shoreway. And then that's what's happened. And so these access points, because of the way the flow is, it's just not as easy. So if you put more cars in there, it actually compounds the problem.
Yeah, worse. I got you.
What if you just let that berm between the pathway and bike and walk pathway on-ramp to the shoreway, but just let that promote the grassland as opposed to, I think it could be a deterrent to people over. So,
I'll have you talk with our operators.
Yeah, we'll continue to evaluate and try to figure out options that make sense. So moving on to our information briefings.
We have with us this morning, Connie Hausman to talk about the South Chagrin Forest Management Project, the near-term results. Morning, Connie.
Good morning, Connie.
Good morning, commissioners.
Thank you.
Really excited to be here. What I first want everybody to do is picture in your mind's eye a forest. Right. And likely this is something that it probably looks like. You have a lush green forest, lots of trees, different sizes, rich understory. But the reality is we often have forests that look like this. Right. And as we're thinking about trying to manage our forest from a future resilience perspective, we need to look at strategies to help rehabilitate sites that show very little vegetation, historical legacies of stress. So what can we do to implement change to help shift the trajectory of these particular forests? And that brings us to the origins of the South Chagrin management. In 2017, we collaborated with Chagrin River Watershed Partners on a grant funded by the Wildlife Conservation Society to identify our cold water stream habitats and look to forest management strategies in the adjacent forest to help those forests adapt through responsible science-based forest management to make sure that we're maintaining the integrity of that interface between our terrestrial and our aquatic systems. This can't be done alone. And so we tapped into lots of different outside resources in the development of this advisory committee to tour several different partners' project sites to evaluate those different adaptation strategies. So the Ohio Division of Natural Resources, Division of Forestry, the U.S. Forest Service, Nature Conservancy, et cetera. We actually also hired a consulting forester with the Wilderness Center to really hone in on those adaptation strategies for our park system. So we identified Sulphur Springs. Sulphur Springs is one of these priority watershed systems. The image that you see is a 1951 aerial photograph, and it's showing some of this area here in which you have these large open pockets. It was a reverted pasture, stopped being pasture land in probably the early 30s. And so the legacy that we have for this particular forest shows that previous land clearing and the condition that I showed you in that picture. We also have lots of information about Sulphur Springs in the fact that there's baseline conditions that we have from our terrestrial systems, our aquatic systems. Sulphur Springs has experienced previous restoration projects. So again, as a priority sub-watershed, we're looking to find then higher in that watershed those terrestrial forests that would benefit from having some portion of adaptive management strategy to rehabilitate that forest system. Our ultimate goals are to ensure our resilient forests, and this is across Cleveland Metro Parks in the system entirety. In this particular location, you can see that's a very dense, dark forest. And so we wanted to make sure that we could ensure that there was proper tree regeneration in this area. We want to enhance those species found in the forest and from a tree regeneration that are going to tolerate future climate change, those that will provide greater wildlife value and diversify our structure and age, setting up a better legacy for future generations in this particular forest. And to accomplish that, we're going to reduce these poorly formed trees. And you can see, you know, we've got trees here with triple trunks, weird, gnarly little branches. They're poorly formed. And again, that's part of the legacy and how they established in that reverted pasture, in that previous land clearing. Over 73% of this forest was just red maple. So that was the measure that we wanted to come in. But we've never really accomplished and tackled a project of this nature before. And so it was really important for us to think about how we wanted to document those baseline conditions, track those changes through time. And we did so by taking aerial images with our drones, again, on those stream surveys, vegetation, cameras, birds, you name it. We wanted to understand what that baseline condition was. We worked with the Division of Forestry at the state to help do a forest inventory. You may have remembered the former chief Bob Boyles was here in 2018 to present on the importance of thoughtful forest management. And so his team came out and they helped us do an inventory here to provide prescribed adaptation strategies that we could implement on the ground. And so in the summer of 2019, so 2018, we collected a bunch of the data. We worked with the division to be able to mark the trees that needed to be removed. That happened in January of 2019. In the summer of 19, we temporarily closed the bridle trail that runs through this site. And then working with our consulting forester, we found a master logger to be able to thoughtfully come in and help remove those trees that would open up the light for us, stimulate that tree regeneration. And you can see that there, each of the trees were marked with paint, they're marked on the stem, and they're marked at the base so we could validate which logs and stumps were removed. The canopy tops, this is kind of interesting. We strategically tried to take advantage of the fact that as these trees were being brought down, the canopies were being left in place. And the canopy of some of the tree species, sugar maple and tulip poplar, are opportunities for browse. And so we invited the zoo crew to come in and take the canopy tops of a couple of sugar maples and tulip poplars that they could take back to the zoo. So this is some of our light conditions. We needed to open up that canopy, and you can see we created these wonderful gaps, lots of light reaching the forest floor. This example here, we got this poor little tree with a very low canopy. It's really tiny and small. And so we're stimulating regeneration from below, but we're also creating room for the existing and surrounding trees to expand their canopies. And in fact, when we look at the light condition before and after, beforehand, the percent open sky, there's 4% open sky, 96 closed canopy, dense and dark. And afterwards, same, 95% closed dark. Our cut management increased that open sky by 25%, which is on par with the proportion of trees that were removed. We wanted to be able to create a thinning that removed about 25 to 30% of that basal area. And in fact, gave this great open sky light environment. And so I'm a big fan of pictures. And so here we can kind of see this before and after image. Again, poorly formed trees, dense and dark. We've opened it up. Proportionally, the tree species that were removed, 76% of what we removed on the site was red maple. So it's a single species selection thinning that we applied here. 14% were black cherry, 5% were ash. Ash, as you know, victim of emerald ash borer. That's one that's not sticking around anyway. About 1%, maybe 1 to 2 trees of the other species were removed from these sites. And there were two different cut management areas accomplished in South Chagrin. Slightly different initial conditions, slightly different thinning strategies, a little bit heavier, more like 25, 30% on one, 15% on another, so we could track those through time. The other thing we did is we utilized the funds from the grant and the funds from the revenue of the cut to be able to put up some exclosures. And so we put up 3 exclosures, one in each of these cut management zones and one in a control area. So we could look at differences between what's happening outside and what's happening inside in these various management areas. In 2021, in May, I was approached by 3 Orange High School seniors that were interested in doing a capstone project. So we tailored a regeneration project, and they did long transects inside of our large exclosure to look at that regeneration, in which Sarah Eisenbach and myself completed the survey by looking at the areas outside of the exclosure and our control sites. So we could understand what type and how many young trees are regenerating in these management areas. The upside is those cut locations inside the fence had 25% more tree species than those that were found in the cut outside portion of the exclosure and our control sites. And not only do we have more tree species, and that's 12 versus 9 tree species. So 25%, we have 25% more tree species. We also have 25% more species in general, more plant species, other herbaceous stuff, blackberry, et cetera. And the vegetation in these cut management sites are also 30% taller.
So what's being excluded?
Deer browse pressure primarily.
Yeah.
So young, tender, little baby trees are highly desirable for deer browse pressure.
I've noticed.
Yeah, so we want to be able to make sure that we're allowing these young guys, these are my baby trees, right? So not as cute maybe as the baby gorilla, but still just as important, I think. This is tulip, poplar, wild black cherry, red oak, and cucumber magnolia. So we want to give these young regenerating trees an opportunity and some time to be able to make it out of that browse pressure.
So what's the period of time of excluding, roughly? Well, you don't know yet.
Right, that's yet to be determined.
Yeah, got it.
We want to be able to make sure that we allow the forest to regenerate and establish in a way that they could then deal with any added pressure back in. So they're not meant to be permanent, but right. We want to be able to track. And so this is adaptive as we move along to determine exactly how long.
And I'm just curious, what percentage of the area was in those exclusionary areas of the whole area that you were studying?
Great, good question. So in total, we had about 24 acres that were managed that was broken into two different units. The one unit was about 15, 16 acres. The other one was about eight or so. The exclosures, the large exclosure is just under 4 acres.
Okay.
And the other one is just about two, just under two, one and a half, closer to one and a half.
And that gives you enough space to really
yeah,
get a good sense of a difference.
Right. And we were constrained on the landscape for where the cut occurred. We wanted to give ourselves buffer and we wanted to leave room outside of it as some comparable area.
Yeah.
Just as an option. So the size of them is highly variable.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
In a mature deciduous forest, like occurred between the Ohio River and the Lake Erie, you know, that was pretty dark, wasn't it? I mean, these were big trees, big canopies. There wasn't much going on down below. So in the case of looking at a mature forest, would you cut down some of the healthy trees like that? That's the lumbering approach, you know. Or would you just say that's a mature forest?
So healthy tree, right? So
yeah.
If ash were removed, you could argue that it's compromised by emerald ash borer. Some of those trees that are poorly formed, they're structurally poorly formed, but is there anything wrong with them from a health perspective? No. And so part of this is trying to balance the opportunity between what's there, the species composition and the structural diversity, and just, you know, intentionally manage to be able to make sure that we're creating a light gap sufficient to get tree regeneration for the future forest, and that it's of a species that's going to be adapted to future climate change, has benefit to wildlife. And so that's where cutting down healthy tree versus unhealthy tree is not necessarily as the driving decision as it is really the
yeah.
whole forest ecosystem in its entirety, not tree to tree decision making.
I mean, you're really concerned about the fact that young trees don't have a chance, right? And isn't it a deer problem, or is it? I mean, are we approaching this in the right way?
It is a combination. It is a deer problem. It is a competition problem. It's an invasive species problem. We're dealing with pests and diseases problems. And so there, you know, deer browse pressure is causing an additional stress. You saw how dark this forest is. This is a before and after. It's dense. It's dark.
Yeah.
Plants need light. We need to be able to give them room. And again, we want to be thinking forward to that age structure and classification to be driving future forest trajectories.
I mean, I see your point where you're saying get rid of the ash trees because they're going to be gone anyway. I mean, just like chestnuts. But the concern I have is that a mature forest is pretty dark.
Well, you got to qualify that because your benchmark is an assumption that is being kind of debunked more and more. It shows pre-European colonization, a lot of these forests were actually managed by native populations like this. This is not necessarily new.
Yeah, this is a pasture.
But it's picking up something that likely predates.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, there are no big trees. I don't see any big trees there. So this is a pasture that randomly
It was a former grew. Pasture. So this land was totally cleared. It was completely
yeah.
cleared for pasture.
It's random.
So we're focusing our strategies on these legacy forests that are kind of originated in a compromised fashion. We're not in our pristine forest sort of navigating that space right now.
Yeah.
We're focusing on these because if left to nothing, there's nothing really to change
right.
course except
I
maybe a natural disaster.
And that's my point, is that what we call pristine isn't necessarily so.
Yeah.
A lot of it was like this, where left untended, it just grew.
I hear you. That's a very good point.
And so as we look at the control areas, what was dense and dark with little vegetation remains dense and dark with little vegetation. And so what are those possibilities to your point for having anything new kind of regenerate in that understory? We're also looking at the wildlife. And so we did a variety of bird surveys. And in 2019, there were several. So you can see this bar down here, about 10 species all the way up to about 26 species, so there's a large range. We did individual surveys in the post years, and they're not far off. We do have a bit of a decline, but, you know, we did have a significant change to that forest, but it's still on par with what was the precondition. And we're really only interested in tracking this looking forward because we expect greater richness and we expect greater forest indicator species to utilize this space. And this is an Acadian flycatcher. And so it was around before and after. It actually had a bit of an improvement. Our hooded warbler had a bit of a decline. And so they really need a structural space where the vegetation gets about 5 to 6 feet tall. We're starting to crest that now. So these are just, these are surveys that are going to be ongoing for us, and we're going to do more of them as we reflect backwards on that data through time. So the drone images, this is kind of cool. This is our before. It's a nice, even, almost looks like a head of broccoli here, smooth carpet. Afterwards, you see there's lots of different pockets, lots of different variability. Those are the gaps that are forming and that we're seeing. We may be able to come in and look at how the upper canopies are starting to infill some of that space through time. So it's regeneration from below. It's also giving those trees that are there room to expand and room to set seed.
And you're also tracking the exclosures with those overheads.
Correct. Yeah. The exclosure is underneath, right around in here. So as an example, 1 meter patch of forest here, there are 6 different tree species in this picture. And all of those that I have highlighted are all species that are slated to tolerate or thrive under future climate models. And so our goal and our objective was to be able to make sure that we stimulated a situation where we were getting tree regeneration, and we're seeing those signs already.
And then you'll see which ones outcompete the others?
Correct. That's part of, by eliminating some of the browse pressure, we allow those natural competitive processes to unfold. And so we are seeing those species tolerant to climate change, greater wildlife diversity. In just this early out kind of data collection, it's already very, very positive. And the exclosure, again, like I said, gives us an opportunity to visualize and track and monitor both what happens in our managed sites inside and outside of that exclosure through time.
That's a dramatic picture.
Mm-hmm. That, and this is only after a single year. The out there right now is even more dramatic. And so we take this opportunity not only to do the management strategies ourselves, but also to share this information. And I helped co-author a book chapter in 2020 with partners from the US Forest Service to look at the impact of climate change on our forested systems. And we use this project as a case study. Additionally, just about a month ago, we had all of the visiting Fulbright scholars in Cleveland. They were here for a climate seminar series that was put on, and we entertained about 37, 38 of them on a tour to be able to look at our forest management site. And not only do we do our programming and our outdoor education programming around this location, but the Division of Forestry comes out themselves, and since there is a bridle trail there, it's accessible. People can see it. And so they do their own tours to be able to illustrate what good sound forest management strategies look like.
Yeah, I think publicizing that picture is rather dramatic, the one.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this. The deer foraging, is it worse than before? Is it the same? Or what do you see? Obviously, you're at the cutting edge here.
Well, when you say before, so deer were extirpated from the state in 1900, and that were only started to be reintroduced to the state of Ohio in, I think, the 1930s. And so the dynamics of what's on the forest floor, how our forests are regenerating, has shifted even from the time that, you know, Europeans first cleared the land when they arrived. And so deer are now also utilizing space differently. They're
I was just talking maybe vibrant. 10 years. Yeah, you know, just to understand if we're doing a good job with deer management.
It's a different issue.
So we run long-term vegetation monitoring projects across the park system to try to understand the condition and the health and the regeneration across all of our forest systems, not even outside of even this particular project site. And we would hope that we're trying to manage that pressure and that stress to a threshold with which it allows our wildlife and our vegetation communities to thrive mutually.
I see.
And there's already been questions, so I thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Really interesting.
Excellent job. Yeah. The next is Judy McKeegan, just a moment in history, golf.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, commissioners. I'm going to, in the interest of time, do this one as quickly as possible and let you know ahead of time, for those of you that are golfers, I apologize. I am not one. I don't know a birdie from a putter. And I know those are two, I know those are two different things, or a duffer or whatever. But I was very interested in mostly what we're going to do today is just kind of look at the courses themselves, how we got them, in what order. I did a quick timeline here to put us in time. Sleepy Hollow actually comes first, though then it comes later. So 1922, Parkland gets Sleepy Hollow. We'll talk more about this in a little bit of depth, but these are, whoops, I'd go back. There's a temporary golf course, now known as Little Met. 1920. So these are all just real brief moments in time that are important. So 1926, that was Big Met. 1944, we actually get Manikiki. It doesn't open till public play until later. Shawnee Hills was built in 1959. 61, Manikiki opens to public play. Sleepy Hollow in 62. Mastic Woods opens in 65. And then we have a big jump to 2006 with our Washington golf course, and then 2011 we acquire Seneca. So individually, Sleepy Hollow is technically our first golf course, although when it began, of course, it was a private club put together by a group of mostly men, at least the ones that were doing the planning, who found this beautiful, beautiful area in Brecksville. What's that? a beautiful area in Brecksville, which is one of the highest places in Cuyahoga County. According to their early reports, you could actually see the city from up there. I'm not sure if that was really true, but they thought it looked very much like the Hudson River Valley area, and hence the name Sleepy Hollow. At the same time that these gentlemen were looking at this land, the Metro Parks, or the Metropolitan Park Board, was looking at this land to try to buy it from a group called Glen Valley. So behind the scenes, I guess there was a little arm wrestling, and what they decided to do was Sleepy Hollow actually bought the land and then immediately sold it back to the parks. So the parks now had this land, but Sleepy Hollow, being the golf club, was going to make the golf course on there, put the improvements in, build a clubhouse, etc. And there was in the contract that within 25 years it would become a public land again, public course. That got extended a little. We don't have time to go into the whole big story of how Sleepy Hollow eventually became a public course. But this is some of the early pictures. They were very proud of their clubhouse, which was done in this Spanish style, as was the Edgewater buildings that had been built around the same time. There was, this is one of those places that Stanley Thompson, a Canadian golf course designer, they call this a Stanley Thompson course. Then there's some debate. Evidently, the first nine holes were not. The second nine holes were at least done by his company, if not him himself, including one, I guess, that's called the Canyon. Again, I'm not a golfer. Hole 14 evidently was a real challenge. And you can see where it says their natural hazards make it one of the hardest courses. I know that it's still a beautiful course today and very desirable. Skipping forward about 40 years, after much debate over who gets to use this and whether it was worth being a public course because it's so difficult, and I'm not sure what that has to do with being a public course, but I think part of it was that the greens fees themselves maybe wouldn't allow for the revenue needed like the private club had. But finally, after much debate in 1962, this lovely cartoon shows up in the Plain Deal, or this Cleveland Press, excuse me, saying Sleepy Hollow public is now welcome. But meanwhile, of course, back in the 20s, just after Sleepy Hollow Golf Course Club opened, they decided they needed some public courses on the west side. Highland was the only public golf course in the early 1920s over on the east side. And so there was land in our new Rocky River Reservation. It was the old White Farm, which was suitable for golf. And so they started looking at creating these golf courses. And I think I've told you guys this before when I've been here talking about the reservation, but Little Met was actually just a temporary golf course, 9 holes, just to give the public somewhere to play while the 18-hole golf course was being designed. And it was being designed by Stanley Thompson and company. But so they called the new golf course when it opened, the very clever name of golf course number one, the 18-hole one. And they were going to close up that temporary 9-hole, but people liked it so much that they kept it open and called it golf course number two. Even though it was built first. So there's your kind of confusion there. Eventually, they took on the names Big Met and Little Met. And honestly, I cannot find in our reports and documents when this officially happened. I think it's one of those things that people started calling it the Metropolitan Golf Course. And then they went to the 18-hole and they called it Big Met, and that kind of stuck. And eventually, it became used in our official wording. But there's no, like, today we opened it up and officially called it Big Met and Little Met. So this is the new park when it opened in 2027, the 18-hole golf course. So that's it as it originally looked. That's Big Met. You'll notice over on the side, it says Mastic Road there. That's actually now the Valley Parkway. And as it went up the hill there to what is now Wooster Road, they called it Mastic Road back then. It confused me for a couple of years when I kept trying to figure out why they said this golf course was on Mastic Road. Well, that's because that's what it was called. This is an artist rendering in 1928 of how popular this golf course was. And it says a mighty mashy mob moves on the Metropolitan. That is not a picture. That is a photoshopped picture. And they even say that the artist rendering of what, because all those people did not come at one time. But throughout the year, it was very, very popular. And as I said, Stanley Thompson, Big Met, and Sleepy Hollow have in common the Stanley Thompson, the famous golf designer from Canada. There's him through the years. And notice had a office at the Bulkley Building in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. So Toronto, Montreal, and Cleveland. Manikiki. Manikiki was created around the same time, a little later than Sleepy Hollow. It was actually out of a club that had been there earlier, the Willowick Golf Club, which decided to change their name and move to the land on the old Hannah Estate up in Willoughby Hills. And they got the estate with the Hannah Mansion and turned the mansion into their golf club, or their clubhouse, excuse me. And Manikiki was, again, a private club, and the land was also private. It had nothing to do with the Metro Parks when they first opened it. Their name that the Willowick Club chose, Manikiki, they looked at calling it Braemar. They looked at calling it, I forget, it's Glenmore. So very Scottish names. And all of a sudden, they end up 2 weeks later with this Willowick. Or, whoops, what happened? With the Manikiki.
It's pretty Scottish.
Newspaper, it's pronounced Manakika. But I don't think that ever stuck. So, and where they got the name, it supposedly means maple forest in Native American language, but nobody really knew exactly what language it was. So that is the name that they chose. And the golf course was very popular, but I think the 1930s put a bit of a kibosh to it. And somewhere along the line, James and Fanny Brown, James Brown was a Cleveland businessman that had made his money in fencing, and they acquired the land. And in 1944, they tried to give it to the city, and the city didn't want it, so they gave it to the Metro Parks. So that's when we acquired Manikiki. It still stayed under Robert Shave was the name of the pro that was working there, and stayed under his control, and it was still a private club. But again, when they got the land, it was with the understanding that in 10 years, I think this one was, that it would become public. Again, there was lots and lots of debate throughout the late 1950s, early 60s, and it finally opened to public play in 1961, just before Sleepy Hollow.
Judy, wasn't that as a result of some litigation, though, that Howard
Metzenbaum? It was, yes, yes. The Howard Metzenbaum, on behalf of his wife, said these are courses where they're owned by the Metropolitan Park Board. This is public land. public people should be allowed to play there. And yeah, it went on for many, many years and eventually ended up because there was talk about selling them so that they wouldn't then they wouldn't belong to the parks anymore. There was talk about doing what we do now with Acacia and Astorhurst, turning them into parkland. And eventually they became open to the public. Shawnee Hills, meanwhile, of course, while all the debate was going on, there had been land put aside in Bedford back in the 1920s, and it was for a golf course that finally came to be in 1959. One of the cool things about Shawnee, it was two 9 holes. And so wasn't an 18 hole, it was literally two separate 9 holes. One was called the white course, one was called the red, and the white course, according to the newspaper, was shorter and suitable for the ladies. So the clubhouse was, interestingly enough, Connie, after your presentation, from trees that had fallen down or been taken down in the park system, they made their new clubhouse, which was very modern looking. Here is a picture in the clubhouse of Mr. Groth, our executive director at the time, and his wife having a laugh with the gentleman at the clubhouse. So. Mastic Woods, another 9-hole golf course. So here in Rocky River, we have Big Met, Little Met, and then in 65, we have Mastic Woods. Again, just a 9-hole course, relieving some of the pressure and some of the crowds from Big and Little Met because of how popular they were. That is a rendering of their golf course, or their clubhouse. I keep saying golf course. Their clubhouse made out of lovely concrete, that they chose. I mean, the people, it was an award, just like we do today. The bid was put out, and these people won, and it was very modern looking. I just came across this picture serendipitously a week ago. This is the first foursome to play Mastic Woods. Notice that the picture's taken. I tried to crop it and show it, but you can't even hardly see the people's faces. And somebody wrote on their back their names and their ages. Notice that Marge Teets there, who's teeing off over on the whatever side that, the right side, she is over 21. That's all they gave about her age. But John Tischler was 65, Wally Vance is 73, and Lloyd Edwards is 68. So I have a feeling Marge might be one of their daughters because she doesn't look like she's the same, but she's over 21. But we don't tell a lady's age in 1965, right? So I thought that was a cool find. And then we just kind of jump ahead and mind you, those golf courses continue to be tweaked and changed. The clubhouses renovated over the years. The courses changed so that if you're playing on Sleepy Hollow's course today, it's not the same one that your grandfather might have played on in 1925. But in 2006, we build a brand new golf course at Washington Reservation, and it is the first 9-hole certified, and I took this right from our website because I wanted to say it exactly right, first 9-hole certified gold signature sanctuary golf course by the Audubon International, and the first gold signature in Ohio. Basically, golf courses built to help encourage wildlife at the same time as having a golf course, which I find fascinating. And it's the first tea project to have a gold signature sanctuary. But what I find interesting about Washington is, yeah, you're on this Audubon sanctuary, but you're right near the city. And this shot, really one of Kyle's pictures, shows it very well. I actually got to work there in the summer of 2020 when we were all working in outdoor occupations. And that is such a popular golf course with people just coming in for lunch to play a quick 9. Of course, the driving range there is also popular. And it's very, very diverse. I mean, different ages, different people. You just see so many different people at this golf course. It really is it's a godsend for that neighborhood, I think. And of course, our first tea program is there where they offer a chance to young people to learn, as the gentleman that run it tell me, not only golf skills, but life skills. So it's a very popular program all over the country, and we're very lucky to have it here, right here in Cleveland. And finally, Seneca. So Seneca Golf Course is actually one of the older golf courses, but it is new to us, newer to us. And I believe that's the same clubhouse that's been there for years. But this golf course is our first golf course that was a public golf course owned by another government entity that then we took on. And notice when it first opened, it was just called the Brecksville Golf Course. It was operated by the city of Cleveland, opened in 1940. And in 1941, they named it Seneca. Again, it was very popular to use American Indian names for golf courses in that era. And that's how they came up with the Seneca name. Again, after the newspaper actually gives the whole debate about why it's called Seneca, but I won't go into that. So again, this is what's kind of unusual. It was opened, it had 36 holes. I think 9 holes open and then another 9 and another 9, and eventually 36 holes were opened by 1942 or 44, so right during the war. And then in 2011, we took over that golf course and began to tweak it and improve it as we do. So I want to leave you with this thought. I found this is from 1896, when golf was fairly new in Cleveland. And I typed it up because it's hard to read that, but I wanted to just show you in situ the actual original one. Any form of sport which is capable of attracting persons of both sexes and all ages into the open air and of furnishing them with a pleasant kind of exercise while there is likely to be welcomed by the large number of people who are beginning to realize the fact, this is one sentence, yep, that a certain amount of healthful recreation is essential to the well-being of both men and women living in the midst of the strenuous conditions of modern American life.
Hear, hear.
Still applies today, right? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
Awesome, Judy.
That was very interesting. Thank you.
The very last one we have is just a quick update on our project update for in Millstream Run and Wallace Lake improvements that we are looking at. Brian dressed up today. He's ready to go.
Sharp.
Good morning, commissioners. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So like Bryce mentioned, you know, Wallace Lake improvements, planning and design was tasked with looking at, you know, some improvements there. You're probably familiar with these master plans created by our staff. Zooming in a little. There we go. A little more on Wallace Lake. I don't know if you can read the top one, a couple, but essentially they notified the existing building needed some upgrades or possibly replaced. There's some ADA issues, just all in all, you know, improvements needed to happen to this building to serve this lake. So the lake itself, super popular with families. It's a bicycle destination. Motorcycle, you know, group stop there. I mean, it's just very popular. Not too far from Baldwin Wallace, so you get a lot of action from there too. Ice fishing as well during the summer. The building itself, like myself, is vintage 1975. Unfortunately, the building has not aged as well as myself. So it's concrete, it's got leaks, a lot of ADA issues. You can see on the bottom right corner there, you know, to get to the concession window, you're underneath this dark, heavy canopy. It's also tucked back in the lower left within the tree, so it kind of disappears from the parkway itself. So we're taking advantage of just the location. So this is the existing location of the building. There's an existing clearing kind of here near the parking lot to fit a new building in there. And a couple of the things that were identified in the master plan were concession building, a new shelter or picnic area, and maybe a space for outdoor education or some sort of classroom space. So you see here again, a concession building in the back, and then we have a shelter up here, and then a separate restroom and changing facility over to the right, a new plaza that leads down, some ADA access to get people with disabilities or wheelchairs down to the beach and to the water itself. Plan-wise, very quickly, again, shelter up on the top, a concession about the same size. If you're familiar with the Huntington project, it's a little bit larger, but same scale of operation. And then similar with the restrooms to the left, these kind of gender neutral restrooms and changing rooms, and taking the lifeguard kind of shack. I mean, that's really what it is, out on the point, and kind of moving that up where the people are so they get a good view of the lake. Conceptual renderings here. This is your approach from Valley Parkway along the parking lot, the restroom building on your left, concession building on your right. There's this kind of portal or entry that, you know, gives you a sense of, hey, I've arrived somewhere, I'm here. This is a view looking back from the beach up at the two buildings. You'll see on the right, this kind of shelter area. I think the next one is up closer. So also the shelter area we're looking at including some glass garage doors here that could be, come down and the shelter could be used in the cooler months. You know, maybe a smaller menu, maybe some sort of, you know, event, ice fishing, you know, it's very popular again. So trying to make this, extend the season a little bit besides just the swimming season. Another one, this is the lifeguard area here to your right, looking back at the building, looking out towards the lake from that shelter with the fireplace. And then, you know, this site has some very high, you know, nice canopy space. So kind of weaving these seating spaces into that existing grass area to kind of give that feel again, extending just from the, you know, daytime swimming area that maybe we have some people that, you know, go on the evening bike rides and stop for ice cream or something like that. So that is passed and that is done.
And what's the timeline for construction?
We're currently, you know, doing the design documents now, but we're monitoring, I mean, like everything, you know, electrical material is taking forever. So we're kind of monitoring that. We're going to have a, bring a CMR, construction manager at risk on soon to help us kind of determine that timeline a little bit better.
Is hope end of this year that you'd start? So open next year, or do you think it'll be next year?
We are wrestling with that right now. It's just, it's one of the things where, you know, we're waiting for the pedestals for dozens of weeks for the, it's just, it depends on the supply chain that allows us to, we can't just put part of it up and not finish. So, but I do want to thank Ryan. This is all Ryan's design. He took time to go through the city of Berea, look at the history, look at the architecture, and he really fits. So I just, I want to give him, it's
great.
Awesome.
Yeah, it really is a huge improvement.
Excellent work.
Thank you.
That is the end of the information briefing items. There is no old business. The next regularly scheduled meeting is Thursday, July 21st. There is an executive session.
There is an executive session?
To go into executive for the purchase acquisition of real estate and pending litigation.
Perfect. We do need a motion to go into executive session.
For those two reasons, so move.
Thank you.
Second.
Roll call, please.
Debbie Berry.
Yes.
Bruce Rinker.
Yes.
Dan Moore.
Yeah.
All right, we will not take any action in executive session. We will be back. Action has been taken. Can I have a motion to adjourn the meeting, please?
So moved.
Seconded, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Meeting over.
Thank you.